We're talking now with Scott Herndon. He's our state senator for District 1 in the Idaho Legislature. Scott, thank you for taking time to talk with us.
My pleasure, Chris.
Well, to start, a lot went on this session, and you're newly elected to the Senate as well. How would you judge the session? Do you think it was a good one, a productive one?
I'd say I was pleasantly surprised because you don't really know, first of all, coming into a Senate where more than 50% of the people are brand new. You don't know what to expect. We knew what leadership had done in previous years. It was a very different Senate, and I think leadership in previous years reflected that particular Senate. And I say they did a great job reflecting our Senate this year. And we had, frankly, a lot more conservative membership this year, and that was a lot of people were more conservative than previous members of the body. So I was curious how leadership was going to respond to that. And what I learned is they pretty much go with whatever their membership is. So I was very pleasantly surprised. They were very accommodative. I was pleased that they were willing to hear pretty much every idea we wanted considered in the body. And so it was a good experience overall. I think we had some good bills passed. We killed a couple of bills that needed to be killed. Some things I wanted didn't pass, and some things I wanted killed didn't get killed. So, but it was
win some, you lose some, right?
That's pretty much how it goes. It's an ongoing process.
Well, we're going to try to go through a bunch of bills that received a lot of attention up here or will be most impactful up here. And let's start with House Bill 292. It's a bill regarding property tax cuts and school bonds. It dedicates nearly $200 million, is the number I saw, or more a year for schools to reduce their debt on bonds and levies, and subsidizes property taxes for residents with homeowners exemptions. There was a rider on the bill that eliminates March dates for school bond and levy elections. Now, Governor Brad Little vetoed the bill, but then the legislature overrode the veto and improved a trailer to address some of his concerns. You voted yes, both for the original bill and to override the governor's veto. Now, the argument against it that I saw was that this bill was pretty complicated. It could have been simplified. And also that it could have been indexed to inflation or a consumer price index or something like that, so it would increase each year or at least follow the trend of the economy. So give us your take on this bill and why you voted for it.
Well, first, I was excited to have the opportunity for the veto override. It's the first time the legislature overrode a governor's veto in Idaho since 2007. Honestly, I think he vetoed the bill, I think, mainly because of the March levy election date that was eliminated by House Bill 292. I think that was the main reason. I think the other explanations that he had were not the primary reasons. The bill was basically a work product that came about because there were several other property tax relief bills that were prioritized at the beginning of the session. I co-sponsored two. One was a simple approach, let's raise the homeowner's exemption, and that was going to be tied to a home price index, and that way it would move as home prices move, and it would have greatly increased the homeowner's exemption from $125,000 to about $224,000. Another bill that I also co-sponsored that I liked quite well was to take some of our sales tax revenues, which of course we're all paying, and then use some of that to as a credit against your property tax, all property tax being local. So it's money we pay to the state, then coming back to pay part of our local property tax bill. That part got put into House Bill 292 because, in fact, half of what 292 does is that bill. Because we had Senator Scott Groh wanted that piece, and then Mike Moyle and Jason Monks over in the House wanted the other part, which basically goes towards school bonds, and it relieves school needs, and so that was what they wanted, and so those two got put together. The homeowner's exemption wasn't impacted at all by House Bill 292, so we pretty much left that alone. Now, the advantage of leaving the homeowner's exemption alone is that everybody gets property tax relief. So renters are going to see relief, commercial property, industrial property, agricultural property. They'll all get relief. Had we just raised the homeowner's exemption, none of those other classes of property would have gotten relief. We're going to see about 19.2% average property tax relief this year, and ongoing, you're going to see a range of 10 to 25% of your property tax is going to be paid for by the state. And in addition, you're going to see a little bit of relief if the schools get some of this money applied to their needs, and then they can then lower what they're going back to the voters for in their levy elections. Mm-hmm. You're going to see additional relief that way. So I think in the end, the result is very good for Idaho.
Well, I think it will be substantial for a lot of homeowners. It'll be several hundred dollars, mm-hmm. probably, and even more maybe for some homeowners with more, with a larger bill, tax bill. On the loss of the March election dates, so the argument I saw against that is it's going to make it even harder for school districts to pass levies, even though they already require a supermajority. What was your take on that?
My take is Boundary County came down and they showed me their levy election results. Jan Bayer up in Boundary County wanted to keep the March levy. I think Becky Meyer here locally wanted to keep the March levy. But the reality was, is in Boundary County, they didn't always pass their March levy, and their most successful levy election date was in May. And so the reality is I think they're still going to be in a good position to pass the levies that they need to pass. And I'm okay with consolidating elections and having fewer, but I could understand their concerns. So I could have gone either way. A lot of times in the legislature, you only have the bill that's before you. And if you don't have enough of a coalition to get that bill changed, then this is the bill you're going to vote on. And property tax relief was a number one priority of voters in this district. And so we made sure to make it happen. And the reason we overrode the veto is because this was the only bill that we were going to get. And we wanted to make sure that we got it done this session.
Okay, let's move on to the next one here. House Bill 314 concerning library materials. This one would have allowed parents to sue schools or libraries if they disseminated harmful materials to minors, and that being defined to include nudity or sexual conduct or sexual excitement or some other terms there. And that successful lawsuits can claim $2,500 in damages for each instance. It passed the legislature, but it was vetoed by the governor, and then an attempt to override the veto failed in the House by just one vote. You got to get a two-thirds majority there. In the Senate, you voted in favor of this bill. I'd say the argument I saw most frequently against the bill is that it infringes on freedom of speech and thought, and shouldn't parents simply control what their own children are checking out of the library rather than expecting the library to enforce that. So what's your take on that one?
First, that House Bill 314 did not ban any materials, so it didn't ban any books. The second, it did infringe on their distribution in libraries because they would still be available there, so we weren't going to prohibit those materials at the libraries. The definition of what we were prohibiting was very simple. And it's a well-tested, Supreme Court-tested test for obscenity. It's already in Idaho code and criminal law. So if you and I were to give obscene materials that are harmful to minors, so that's the key definition, is what is harmful to a minor. And it actually is sexually oriented, and it uses the word prurient. And if you look that up, it's excessive interest in sexual excitation, basically. So it's not appropriate material for minors. We use the Miller test. The Supreme Court's tested it for 50 years. It uses community standards as to what's unacceptable sexually oriented material for minors. And because these are government libraries, that's why the government has an interest in this. We're not talking to private businesses. I voted against a bill that would have required cell phone manufacturers to turn on a porn filter when the minor activates it in the state. And the reason I was against that is because that's private industry, but these are government libraries. And there is a real problem. I saw the materials. They're not like the materials that you and I would have had in our libraries and our schools back when we were that young. Things have changed. And so the bill did was that the library couldn't give those materials to minors, and that the library had to take reasonable steps to make sure that those materials did not get into the hands of minors. If they took the reasonable steps and somehow material got into the hands of minors, they would have been fine. The thing the governor really didn't like was he didn't like the right for statutory damages, but that's an old common law mechanism We actually just did the very same thing in Senate Bill 1100, which I know you're also interested in, and that's the bathroom bill. And we did the same thing on that bill. So I really think it was the content of the legislation itself. It wasn't really so much that statutory damage right and the right of people to sue. And it really had to do with what are we doing in this bill? And I think what we were doing in the bill was sexual excitement materials that are obscene that you and I would be charged with the crime today if we gave them to a minor walking by on the street. Those are the materials we're talking about. And we're going to probably come back and try to accomplish something again mm-hmm. on that next year because we tried it last year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't see this one going away. Mm-hmm. We'll have to find a solution.
I was going to point that out, that it didn't pass, but it may come up again.
Yeah.
So, well, you actually mentioned the school bathroom bill, so let's just jump onto that. That was Senate Bill 1100, and it creates a state policy to ensure a separate school bathrooms and locker rooms based on a student's sex at birth, allows students to actually sue schools for damages if they find a member of the opposite sex in a bathroom. This one passed. The governor did sign it. You were in favor of it. The argument I saw against it was that one of the legislators who opposed it argued that it leaves out people who are intersex or transgender and creates, you know, problems for those kinds of students. What was your, you know, basis for your decision on that one?
My basis is it didn't leave anybody out because, number one, everybody is born either biologically male or female, and there are very few exceptions where that's not the case, where it's not identifiable. But even those people, the bill accommodated because there's accommodations in the bill. And all we're saying is that those who have the biological parts and the biological indicator of sex on their birth certificate of male have to use a male restroom, and females have to use a female restroom. And as far as the ability for people to sue, it's only if there were two conditions, and it's if the school doesn't take reasonable precautions to prevent people of opposite sex from getting into a bathroom, or if the school specifically allows people from the opposite sex into the bathroom. So if someone sneaks into a bathroom without the school's awareness, and if they took reasonable steps to prevent that, the school's not going to be liable in this situation. So to me, this was a common sense bill, and it had to do with respecting, mainly when you think of these bills, you think of girls. And we did the women's sports bill a few years ago, House Bill 500 in 2020. And the whole idea there is that the girls want the protection. Becky Meyer, when she came down, you know, LPOSD superintendent, and she said their number one priority, she was representing the region, the number one thing the schools wanted was Senate Bill 1100. They wanted cover from the state to say that male restrooms are for males, female restrooms are for females. If they're going to accommodate someone, they can do it in a single-use facility. Mm-hmm. And that's the accommodation. And the reason they want to cover is because they want to be sued and be liable for the decisions they make locally. They wanted to be able to point to a uniform authority, state level, from the legislature. And we got that done this year.
Okay. Well, next bill also concerns minors, and it's House Bill 242. It has to do with transporting minors for abortions. This criminalizes transporting a pregnant minor who's seeking an abortion out of state or providing her with an abortion-inducing drug without their parents' knowledge. It includes a penalty of 2 to 5 years in prison. The governor signed this one into law. You voted in favor of it. The arguments that I saw, the legislators who opposed this bill said that it did not clearly define who qualifies as a parent or a guardian. Planned Parenthood has also said that they're intending to bring a legal challenge on this one. Give us your take on House Bill 242.
Well, so we have an abortion ban in the state of Idaho, and we can't ban interstate transport of, you know, your ability to travel interstate. That's a federal constitutional right, and that applies to everybody in the state of Idaho. And so that certainly was never going to be anything that's on the table. And if people are getting an abortion and they live in the state of Idaho, they're probably going to go travel interstate, go to Washington or somewhere else. And all this bill did was it targeted minors, children under 18, and it only makes it a crime if you transport that minor without the parent's permission. So I've been in discussion with people about this. This is an example of you get this bill, the Republicans all voted for it, the Democrats all voted against it. It almost becomes a team Republican versus team Democrat. I don't know what the legal angle is as far as, you know, future lawsuits and what we think the constitutional basis is to, but clearly the bill is really about parental rights. And so it relies on other sections of Idaho code and the clear definition of who is a parent and guardian, which when you go to the Child Protective Act statutes, that's super clear. And I don't know what the future holds for this bill, but I think from a parental rights perspective and from a statement against transporting minors out of state for abortions without their parents' consent, it made sense, and it really came down to team Republican versus team Democrat in this case.
Okay, well, there was another abortion-related bill that came up. It's House Bill 374, which creates exceptions to the abortion ban for miscarriages. It clarifies that medical treatment for miscarriages and ectopic pregnancies are allowable under the abortion ban. The governor signed that one into law. You voted yes for that one. I think the argument would be from those who oppose abortion, they simply believe all abortion procedures should be prohibited. What is your take on that one?
So we started the session January 9th, and we got our Supreme Court decision in Planned Parenthood versus State on January 5th. And if you went through that Planned Parenthood decision by the Supreme Court of Idaho, it's 139 pages, and it made it very clear that our current abortion ban, which is 18622 Idaho Code, it was already very clear that treating an ectopic pregnancy, treating a pregnancy where a mother where the baby has already died, treating a mother who is having a miscarriage, treating a mother who has a molar pregnancy, that these things were not a criminal act. The Supreme Court opinion was very clear about that because Idaho Code was actually very clear that an abortion is the termination of a clinically diagnosable pregnancy when a fetus is developing, and a fetus is only developing if the fetus is alive. And so in an ectopic pregnancy, that's most often not the case.
If the fetus is developing outside the uterus, so it doesn't really have a chance to survive.
Yeah, the bill, the law says that you've got to try to save the mother's life. And while doing so, you should also try to save the child's life if the child is still alive. But in medical treatment, you are allowed to prioritize your patient. Republicans wanted to make it, basically take that Supreme Court opinion and make it very clear that certain things fall outside of the abortion criminal statute, such as treating an ectopic pregnancy. And that's what House Bill 374 did. The other thing I really hated about the abortion ban was the use of affirmative defense. On page 78 of the Supreme Court's opinion, they said that the legislature can use affirmative defense. What it is, it's a presumption of guilt. It basically, if a doctor treated a woman legitimately, he could be charged with the crime, and his affirmative defense is, but I was saving her life, or but the child was deceased, but he's got to hire a defense attorney and he's charged with the crime. I don't like that approach. And the Supreme Court on page 78 said, we don't tell the legislature what is the wisest approach. We only tell them what is the constitutional approach. And it's constitutional to have an abortion ban, but it's not the wisest approach to go with an affirmative defense. It's better to have a true exception. So that was the other key thing that House Bill 374 did, is it got rid of the affirmative defense so that now you have true exceptions, like such as when a doctor's saving a mother's life or when he's treating an ectopic pregnancy, and he cannot be charged with a crime in any case. It is a true exception. So to me, this was a definite yes vote because it took care of clarifying language and getting rid of the affirmative defense.
Boy, for each of these bills, we could have an extended conversation. This one's really pertinent right now because Bonner General Health just decided that they needed to discontinue delivering labor services here. And part of the reason they cite several reasons, just the demographics here with people getting older and fewer families. But one of the reasons they say is they're having trouble keeping pediatric physicians on because they are afraid of legal consequences with the abortion ban. Did they speak to you during the course of the session, folks from Bonner General?
Bonner General did not. There are two primary reasons that they closed or that they are closing, really is a demographic and a business problem. There are so many changes in healthcare. There are so many changes to demographics of Bonner County. I think our average age is now 47 and a half years old. So you're losing the population base. And also, Americans aren't having as many children. Mm-hmm. So the per parent child ratio right now is going way down. And so it's really a business decision. And then it goes also into who your payers are. Single payer, the government through Medicare and Medicaid is single payer mechanism. And it just has really changed the business environment for labor and delivery at hospitals. And so Kootenai Health is operating in the same political environment and it's thriving. And the reason has to do with business decisions and population centers and consolidation in the industry.
Almost four times as many people there, so they have a much...
Yeah.
I think Bonner General said we had 265 deliveries at the hospital last year, and they really need about twice that.
Yeah, yeah. It's just going down. And so what's happening too, I will tell you what the hospitals, not the hospitals, but the IMA, they wanted to do more abortions. But what's interesting, they wanted to do it in the case where a mother's health could be in danger at some point in the future. A great example they told me was, well, she could have a cardiovascular congestive condition where if she gets pregnant, puts strain on her heart, and that could increase the risk to her health and life. And or she needs treatment for cancer right now, radiation, chemotherapy, but she's pregnant. So if we abort the baby now, we can give her treatment. She lives to see another day, can have a baby in the future. These are the things they asked for, and these are the things this legislature was not willing to grant. I think there was a little bit of politics at play, trying to put some pressure on the legislature. What is interesting is over the last 10 years, and all of our northern hospitals, we have a mandatory reporting law for induced abortion, and no hospitals, no counties outside of two primary counties, Twin Falls and Ada, have reported any abortions in the last 15 years. So they're either not complying with the reporting law or they're not actually doing abortions based on the definition of abortion in Idaho code. I suspect it's that, but maybe
it's
they're
doing mostly that they're not doing.
I don't think they're doing them. Yeah. And I think this is political pressure.
Okay, well, moving on, because we only have a few minutes per bill here. House Bill 71 is concerning gender-affirming care. This one makes it a felony to provide transgender children with gender-affirming medical care. Providers will be barred from giving minors hormones, puberty blockers, or transition-related surgeries. This bill passed the House and the Senate, and the governor signed it into law. You voted for it. The argument against it, I'd say there was probably more general agreement that a permanent procedure such as surgery should not occur until a child becomes an adult. But this law will deny other types of care to children who are experiencing gender dysphoria. In many cases, they're suffering to the extent that they become suicidal. So how would you respond to that? And the other argument here is basically, is this government overreach into the private decisions of families?
I don't think it is. I think this is government protecting children from permanent harm. I think we got a lot of testimonies from some very knowledgeable people. We were in Senate Republican caucus room, and we had physicians that are very knowledgeable in this space participate in private meetings with us and give us a completely opposing views, legitimate back and forth, and we were able to dissect, and we believe that blocking puberty blockers and hormone therapies for children, that if we didn't block those, that they actually do cause long-term permanent harm to children. And I think we were entering into a space here where we wouldn't have had this conversation 50 years ago because these things were not happening, but it's necessary now because they are happening. And we're trying to prevent permanent harm to children. And that's really what we were trying to do with House Bill 71.
Okay, Next one. This was a hot button issue as well. This is Senate Bill 1056 on concerning private militias. It would have repealed a state law that prohibits private militias and paramilitary organizations from carrying firearms around. The Senate passed the bill 24-9, but didn't receive a hearing in the House, so it died over in the House. You voted for it. And I'd say that the argument against this one was that a lot of residents here were alarmed by all the armed guys that were hanging around downtown during the protests in 2020. They felt intimidated by that. Even the Second Amendment ensures our right to keep and bear arms, but it states that militias should be well regulated, which I think you can interpret it implies that's a state-sponsored militia, like the National Guard, not a paramilitary group, some guys that just get together on weekends to practice. So why were you in favor of that one? It didn't proceed, so it may come up again in the future, I guess.
Yeah, man, I have no idea. But generally speaking, it repealed a section of code, but it also added it back, so there were still some parameters. But really, when we're making state law, we look primarily at the Idaho state constitution and not the federal constitution. And the right to keep and bear arms is a personal right in the state constitution. So a lot of times when we're passing legislation at the state level, we're really respecting the state constitution more than the federal constitution. People will refer to the Second Amendment because it's easy nomenclature. People know what you're talking about. But the right to personally keeping and bearing of arms and the personal use of arms is well established in the Idaho Constitution. And I think we are respecting the parameters that the Idaho Constitution has set around this subject. And there was unnecessary statutory regulation that was in contrast to the rights contained in the Idaho Constitution. And that's why I was comfortable voting for it. And that's why I don't know if we're going to see it come up again. But, you know, when we're making decisions, when I make decisions, it's the first thing I look at is what does the Idaho Constitution say? And that was the reason for my I vote.
Hmm. Okay, moving on. Put together a couple of bills here. House Bill 124 concerned student ID, and it eliminated the ability of students to use an ID card to vote. You voted for it, and it did pass into law. Then House Bill 340 was a free voter ID bill, and that directs the Idaho Department of Transportation to issue no-cost ID cards for the purpose of voting. And the governor signed both of those into law. So on that one, however, you voted nay. So I guess the argument here would be, why don't we want to make it easy for people to vote and get as many citizens participating in the election as possible?
Yeah, and this was a key question. House Bill 124, I was actually the Senate sponsor. And House Bill 124, by eliminating a student ID, the reason we did that is because there's no uniformity in those IDs. So they don't all display the same information. They vary. We're talking about high schools and colleges. And also the proof of identity in order to get one is not the same as for a government-issued ID. So the IDs that we retained for voter verification are government-issued IDs. They very typically require you present a birth certificate, you present a social security number. Student IDs do not. So the reason we wanted to get rid of it is for uniformity's sake. On House Bill 340, so we don't eliminate access either, because everybody who's eligible to get a student ID is eligible to get a state-issued ID. And in fact, student ID is one of the least used next to tribal ID. It was the second to last least used. Only 104 people used it in the November general election in 2022.
In the whole state.
In the whole state.
Yeah, I think Mark Sauter told me only two people used it here in our county.
Yeah, so this is kind of a low-hanging fruit for uniformity of identification. They could also still go straight to the poll and sign a personal affidavit, attesting that they are who they are. House Bill 340 was actually much more complicated than just the one free voter ID. You made a bunch of uniformity between IDs needed to register to vote versus IDs needed to vote. And the reason I voted nay is because of this iPhone right here. This iPhone costs quite a bit of money. Most students have one. And it only gives free IDs to students. And I actually don't think we need to give away a $15 ID to students who probably have a smartphone in their pocket. They can probably afford a phone. I'm not opposed to the fact that it passed. It's just that my no vote is because I didn't want to create a new government subsidy. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't about the fact that we want to help students access the polls and get an ID. It was more about the fact that I honestly think those students can afford to buy the ID. It's a state-issued ID card that's $15.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Senate Bill 1025 concerning marriage licenses. This is actually a bill that you sponsored. It would have eliminated marriage licenses in favor of marriage certificates for qualified couples. It failed in the Senate. You sponsored it, so I think you voted for it.
I did.
But the argument that I was able to dig up against this, one of your fellow senators expressed a concern that it might restrict legal marriages for same-sex couples, and she raised a question about whether IRS tax status might be affected.
Yeah. And the answer is it does neither of those. So we checked into that. So we had multiple attorneys tell us, according to federal law, veterans benefits, tax status, and same-sex marriage is not impacted at all, which was my understanding going in. Literally, the only thing I'm doing with that bill, and I'll run it again next year, I'm going to make a slight change that I think will get it to pass in the Senate. It only failed 16-17-2. Two were absent. And so I had actually 16 Republicans vote in favor of it, which we have a 28-member caucus. Only 10 Republicans voted against it. I know exactly why they did. I know what the fix is. And all we're doing there, Mike Rosedale, the Canyon County clerk, both testified in favor of the bill. And we already have marriage certificates. And so the thing that I'm getting rid of is the license part, because license is a grant of permission. And historically, we didn't used to grant permission for two qualified people to marry. The reason we implemented marriage licensing in the state of Idaho, when we first became a state, we didn't have marriage licenses. We implemented them in 1899 to prevent interracial marriage. It's a really terrible history. We finally got rid of our anti-miscegenation laws. That's, you cannot marry if you're different national origins, different color of skin. We got rid of that in 1959, and we still used the marriage license to test for diseases. We also used it to give out an AIDS pamphlet and a bunch of things that we don't do anymore. And so there's no legitimate reason to retain a license. However, there is a legitimate reason to maintain the certificate that we have now, but we're going to expand the certificate. This bill did it. Next year, that's the approach I'm going to take. We'll go ahead and have them start at the county clerk next year to get the certificate, take it to their minister, get married with the ceremony, get the certificate filled out, return it. That's their legal document of record. Getting rid of marriage license is getting rid of the historical idea, this short period of time in Idaho of 100 years where we were preventing interracial marriage, requiring blood testing and disease testing and different things like that that we don't do anymore. And we don't want to say that the state has authority over who gets to get married. And that's really what that was about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to push on just a couple more. We're actually running long, but we're going to run long. It's too much to talk about here. Senate Joint Resolution 101 concerning citizen initiatives. This would have amended the Idaho Constitution to require 6% of the voters in each of Idaho's 35 legislative districts to sign a petition in order to get an initiative on the ballot. And it would have needed a 2/3 approval from both the House and the Senate, and then approval from a majority of the voters. The bill was adopted by the Senate. However, it failed in the House, so it's not going to proceed. But you voted in favor of it. And I guess the argument opposed to that is that, it goes to whether or not we want to maintain a usable citizen initiative process. The right for citizen initiatives is in the Idaho Constitution, and it's already really pretty difficult for citizens to get an initiative on the ballot, and this would make it, or so the argument is, almost impossible. And it would give that single legislative district basically a veto over all the others if just one refused to, or didn't muster up 6%. So give us your take on that.
So the initiative process was only added to the Idaho Constitution in the, I want to say 1913, somewhere right around there, 1913, 1919, somewhere in that time range. So when we started as a state, we didn't have that. So the idea behind the United States, not every state has the ballot initiative. Mm-hmm. In fact, a minority of them do. And we're one of those. And the idea is it's direct democracy. So citizens can make a law through a ballot initiative versus going through the representative Republican. And I don't mean that Republican Democrat, right. But that is the format of our government. Is I'm down there.
It's a Republican form of government.
Yeah. And so, in fact, I did that for several people in North Idaho. I had 9 bills signed into law. And 3 or 4 of them were given to me by Bonner County or Boundary County citizens because they had a problem that needed to get fixed. And so that's really the idea of how our government is supposed to work. I like the idea of the ballot initiative. However, I also liked this Senate joint resolution because making legislation should be really hard. It actually is really hard. There were bills that you really have to work at to get passed. And with the ballot initiative and the changing demographics again, Ada County growing and Twin Falls County growing, you can get all of the ballot initiative signatures in just those two counties.
But it's 6% in 18 counties, so you have to meet that threshold currently.
No, it's 18 legislative districts, legislative districts in Ada County. Hmm. So I think when you combine, there's 3 legislative districts in Twin Falls. I think you could put together 4 counties that are the metropolitan counties, and you can get all of your signatures there and make the ballot. And so you can literally leave out 40 of 44 counties right now. Mm-hmm. You could make the ballot under the current structure. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of opposite of the way the legislature works. The way the legislature works is I have this great idea that looks great to everybody from North Idaho. And I find out that rural Southeast Idaho, it's harmful to them and they hate it. And so sure enough, in the legislative process, if Southeast Idaho hates something, they can muster up enough support to kill it. But in the ballot initiative process, they can't. And so this was gonna basically equal that up. There were two standards in ballot initiative. You have to make the ballot, then you have to pass at the polls. That's where everybody gets to say. And if you think about the legislative process, you have to pass a committee on the House side, you have to pass the House floor, you have to pass a committee on the Senate side, you have to pass the Senate floor. All 35 legislative districts get to weigh in. And that really, to me, this mimicked it. It's having everybody weigh in before something becomes law.
Scott Herndon, we're going to leave some on the table because we're out of time. We're past our time. Thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.